Wally, much of your answer was focused around the air coupe. It's a slow airplane. You can roll down the sides. It's an enjoyable, take your time kind of mission. What if you were in a different airplane? What if you were in a high performance single and your mission was just to like get in there, pick up your buddy, and get out of there? VFR, would that change your answer? Same route, same final destination up at the beach.
Given this bluebird day, I think my route would be exactly the same. I'd slow the high-performance airplane down to a reasonable speed to fit into the pattern and just do the same route just because it feeds me into that pattern so nicely.
Richard, you're doing the same thing as Wally. You're taking the long way around. Is your reasoning the same as Wally's, mostly that, it's a beautiful day, I'll take my time? Or is it, that's just the best route, and even if I wasn't in an air coupe, even if I was in something faster, that's the way I would go?
Yeah, it's more that. It's more that I think that's the best route to take, given how crowded this airspace is. And if I were in a high-performance airplane, I'd be even more inclined to take that northern route to give me more time to sort this out. And Jeff, you made a good point that's a really subtle one. Just because you're flying a high-performance airplane doesn't mean you have to fly it at high performance. There are times when you should slow the airplane down, drop some flaps if you want, or allow the situation to slow down so you can keep pace, allow the game to slow down a little bit. So, either way, to me, that northern route it's more comfortable, it gives you more time to assess things, and it costs you a couple minutes of time, maybe. I'll trade that.
So there are three people at the table who are taking the northern route. Sarah, you're the next one up. Same thinking, something slightly different. What's your reasoning?
My reasoning is, once again, the same thing. It's a little bit less complex. I didn't have a second radio in my 182 or my Super Cub for the longest time, and I still continue to fly IFR in those aircraft, and it can be a challenge to divide your attention. The other thing, too, is that on the notes, Herlong stated that they had glider and ultralight activity, and oftentimes you're lucky to even get even one radio call from those people. So by switching at the last minute when I'm already really close to the airport, 4 or 5 miles out, I might miss on an opportunity to hear about traffic that's entering the area.
Glider and other activity. There's also parachute activity, skydiving at that airport too. If you didn't do the research, you wouldn't notice that in there. On to you, John. You're a two. How are you going to go through Cecil's airspace? And you did say it was with kind of a caveat. So maybe you can expand on that for me.
Sure. I'm going to go, but direct. But I'm going to talk to Jack's approach.
Interesting.
I'm going to call them first, okay, while I'm still 25, 30 miles out. Tell them what I want. Let them coordinate with the tower. First, they'll know if the White House NOLF is active or not without calling flight service, without checking anything. So right away, you'll know. And if it, in fact, is active, let them deal with the coordination. I'm sure they have letters of agreement or there's some sort of procedures. You know, they might flash the data block at the tower. There's got to be some procedure because we're not the first airplane to approach this from the west. So the approach is required to coordinate. And I could talk a lot more about that, but maybe we'll move on and come back to me on that.
I can come back to you on that. And I definitely want to pick up that when you're calling them, you know, you may be high enough coming through that it turns out, even though it's technically the Class Delta airspace, it's Jacksonville, right, that could be controlling that.
Well, Jacksonville owns, unless they have a letter of agreement, Jacksonville owns above 2,600, which is top of Cecil.
But they may own even lower.
They may own even lower. They may have some sort of internal thing that you don't even know about. Plus, they'll know the traffic flow there, so it just makes it a whole lot easier to deal with them.
Kevin, you're doing a sort of split decision here. Might be one, might be two. Enlighten us. Why? What's your thinking and your plan?
Well, I guess I'll just walk through the plan, really. Being west of the Class Deltas is when I would be listening to the one-minute weather at the destination. And I want to get that out of the way prior to calling for a Delta transition because I don't want to deal with that going through the Class Delta, especially with a single comm radio. But I do want to fly through those deltas because I feel like the person, the tower controller working those deltas is going to be in a really great spot to have me separated from the other airplanes in the airspace. If you're right outside of the edge of the Delta, you're probably still going to be a conflict for traffic that's arriving or departing those Delta airports. And that happens frequently with traffic that is going just a mile outside the Delta type of a thing, which is kind of what we're talking about. You're still going to be a traffic conflict for the traffic that's going in and out of there, if there is any. So going through either of the Deltas, and I don't have a preference either way, I'd flip a coin and pick one, and that would be the first one I'd call. And if they said, sure, transition approved, no big deal, then I'd jog slightly in that direction to be in that Delta, probably be out of their way. I'd also want to be down low enough where I'm at pattern altitude prior to exiting the Delta. I don't want to have an altitude constraint going through the Delta that's going to keep me up high because I don't want to descend into the pattern at the destination. And then flying through the Delta, I'm going to want to get over to that CTAF frequency as soon as I can. So if there's not a traffic conflict, I'm going to be asking that tower controller, hey, is it okay if I switch over to CTAF, or do you need me for something for now? And maybe they'll have to keep you for another minute or two, but maybe they won't and they can release you.
Right. And that's kind of what I was leading at, looking for, you know, what's your plan once you're sort of past the runway midline, if you will, at Cecil? And it's like, okay, you know, you're going to be barreling into Herlong one way or another here. Did you want to do it at pattern altitude? Did you want to do it above pattern altitude and cross over? Were you going to ask the controller to switch early, even though you're still in the Delta airspace? Sarah?
Another thing to think about, too, when we're talking about parachute activity in particular, is that oftentimes they're not talking to people on the CTAF about parachute activity. That's something that center would definitely approach, or center would definitely be aware of, as well as likely the class Delta towers. That being said, it's been my experience that at a lot of untowered fields that have parachute activity, that somebody will actually be monitoring from the ground and calling people out by tail number ADSB and just making people aware of those operations. But there's no guarantee of that. So I would definitely, I'd have chosen to do option 4, but definitely at some point in that procedure, maybe say, ask something of the tower, ask something of approach, and ask them about the parachute activity.
JP.
Yeah, I specifically, really like the idea of contacting Jacksonville Approach and letting them handle the coordination with this, because they are the radar services for this area, and they can coordinate between some of this Class D airspace, and it keeps you're not just a target transitioning through here that at first nobody even knows about, and then here you are entering Class D airspace, what your intentions are. It takes care of a lot of that before you even get to that point, which I really like. And I do think, just like what we were talking about, we are not the first airplane to land at this airport. This is something that I'm sure they probably handle quite frequently, and there's a procedure in place.
Wally.
And I think calling Jacksonville Approach is a good idea, and I frankly wish I'd have thought of that in my response, but I didn't. So, but the fact is, I don't think Jacksonville Approach knows much about what's going on at Herlong in that traffic pattern. They probably get the call from the parachute guy that's at 14,000. But now the parachuters are opening their chutes and they're fluttering down there at Herlong. Plus the gliders are may or may not be talking to Jacksonville Approach, most likely not. So there's a lot of things going on there. And to me, there's a great benefit in being able to monitor that CTAF and begin to build a mental picture before I get within 3 miles of the airport or so. But Jacksonville Approach can sure provide a lot of help, I agree.
John?
Yeah, so I'll go back to my choice of calling Jacks. For even more reasons, because of the parachute jumping. So they will definitely know if there's a parachute plane up, because it's going to be in airspace. They're required to coordinate that. But I wanted to talk about that. There's a really interesting legal conundrum that comes into play here. And it's with VFR aircraft receiving radar advisories approaching a Class D. Okay, the FAA has actually published a letter. I don't know if you've ever seen this, too. It's a letter to controllers advising them how to handle this, because there's two conflicting sections, actually. So in the controller's handbook, it says that the approach controller must coordinate with the appropriate control tower for transit authorization when you are providing radar traffic advisory service to an aircraft that will enter another facility's airspace. And then the note says, pilot is not expected to obtain his or her own authorization when in contact with a radar facility. Okay, so it lays it pretty clearly right there on the approach controller. If you're providing radar service, you have to coordinate with the surface facility, which in this case is the control tower.
Let me just for clarity here, okay, because we may have some people listening who aren't familiar with the terminology that you're using, but they are the okay. other way. If you've got flight following and you're talking to that controller, you don't have to talk to the class delta, is what you've started to say, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Here's the however. Okay.
There's always a catch.
There's always a catch. The pilot's responsibility to comply with 91.129, which is communication with Class D towers, is not absolved by this paragraph. The pilot is still responsible for closing the loop. So the way it would work in practice, you call the approach controller, you say, I'm going there. The controller says, Roger. That is half the requirement goes on the controller, but the pilot needs to hear that they've been cleared through or they've been coordinated or something. It's like approaching a class Bravo. You know, just because you're talking to the controller doesn't mean you're cleared to enter the Bravo. So the pilot is still responsible to meet the radio communication requirement to enter Class D. How they do it is either through the approach controller or you have to terminate and do it on your own. So in this case, talking to the approach controller first could make it very simple and just tell the approach controller you want to terminate as soon as possible so you can go over to Herlong.
Sarah.
And seconding what he said, it's true. Air traffic controllers, if you get flight following, it does not exempt you from the requirements for any special use airspace either. People think, oh, I'm on with approach or I get flight following, that somehow that absolves them of responsibilities when it comes down to airspace, and it doesn't. And I've heard of countless scenarios where people have been violated while getting flight following who flew through a restricted area or something of that nature. So, you know, he's pointing out that's really important, is that just because you have flight following does not mean that you're automatically can fly wherever you want.
Richard.
So I feel like now with that added explanation from John, which is really helpful, that by contacting Jacksonville, you've just complicated the situation and you've added a big unknown, because now I don't know how they're going to react. They may clear me through. They may not. They may transition me into the Delta when I'm in the Delta. Now I'm unprepared for it. So it's just another reason why on second review, I wouldn't contact Jacksonville Approach. Now, what I would do, if I were going to go through the Delta like that, I would ask one of the towers, whichever one I decided to cut through, hey, do you have radar and can you see, is there any traffic over at my destination there? And they should be able to give you a heads up, just at least so you know whether or not there's traffic, given that you're a single radio and you can't monitor it.
Wally.
I think they're probably going to say, yeah, we have the radar and there's multiple targets around the airport and parachuters dropping through the middle of it, you know?
Right. And what do you do with that information?
Frequency change approved.
But I did want to say, Richard, thank you for starting out by saying it's giving me a headache, all these rules.
Yeah.
Because I can fly with my radio tuned to the Herlong CTAF and I can hear what's going on if I go my way. Mm-hmm. And I'm just putting along very nicely and I don't have to listen to all the jibber jabber of Jacksonville Approach, who we know they can be pretty busy if they've got some planes coming and going. And, you know, we may hit them at a quiet time, we may hit them at a busy time, but I like just driving in there low and slow and quiet.
You know, talking to people is going to be the theme of this whole scenario, because we actually decided to give a call to Herlong and try and talk to a local and say, hey, how does this work, right? Because this has to happen all the time. And what we found out was CECL allows transitions 500 feet above traffic pattern altitude with an early frequency change. And they'll basically say about when you get Herlong in sight, it turns out that's roughly when they would do it. So, and any other route across the airspace usually isn't a problem. The interesting thing though, the really interesting one was White House. And this gets to studying the chart. And I didn't bring this up beforehand because I didn't notice it initially. You didn't notice it. The tower frequency for White House is the tower frequency for the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. If you call the White House tower, you're going to get almost always Jacksonville. And they're the ones who are going to say, yeah, that's never active. Like, it's very rarely active. And what they'll do is they'll tell you to use 135.4 for pilot-to-pilot communications and self-announce. And that, and hand you off to there. Turns out the flight schools in the area use the White House airspace when it's not active. That's where everybody's practice is. That's their sort of practice area up there. And you're given this self-announce on this frequency that, you know, if you had gotten that just, yeah, Wally was like looking at me, shrugging your shoulders, like, what am I supposed to do with that? If you hadn't called ahead, now talk about a headache, right? You're like, there's this other procedure. What does that even mean? What am I supposed to do? You tune to it and there are these flight school airplanes all saying where they are and what they're doing on that frequency.
It's probably sounding, using local landmarks.
Yeah, using local landmarks you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. So it just got even more complicated in what seemed to be complicated. John,
you want to add something? That's, one of the things I was going to say is was called the tower before, mm-hmm. before you even take off and get that. But even that is more reason to initially talk to Jack's approach, because they're going to have that information and they're going to say, are you familiar with the White House practice area, or, you know, some words to that effect. And they might even switch you over to that air-to-air frequency first before you go to Herlong. So all the more reason to get into the system and not be that guy that we see all the time that's 4.9 miles going around the Delta on a 1200 code and you have no idea what they're doing. You know, that you look at the final approach courses for Cecil, you're probably crossing right at the final approach fix just outside the 5 mile ring there, you know, 1700 feet or so, right at glide slope altitude on pretty much any one of those runways. So all the more reason to get into the system.
Wow, and I think, and all the more reason not to get into the system. We're going to vote again here, basically, like, just who's contacting Jacksonville Approach and who is like, I'm not talking to anybody, I'm just listening to, so not talking to anybody, show of hands, 1, 2, 3, literally on my right side, calling Jacksonville Approach, 1, 2, 2 on my left side. Kevin, you didn't take one of my two options. What's behind door number 3?
Glass Delta transition, like I started with. I'm still sticking with that.
And
with,
you're still checks. Going to yep. Cecil, probably? Because if you do it to White House, you're going to hear Jacksonville Naval Air Station, is it?
Yeah, if I'm right. If I'm talking to, if I hear that that's going to be a bit of a beehive of student pilots flying around type of a thing, mm-hmm. then that's going to drive me even harder into that Class Delta to transition Cecil to get over there. I would expect, if I'm talking to approach going through a Class Delta, generally you're going to get some type of a restriction mm-hmm. at or above an altitude or something. And if you want to do something contrary to that, that approach controller has to call that tower controller and say, hey, this bug smasher flying through over here wants to do this instead of this. Is that okay? And then the tower controller might say no, or they might say yes, but put them on my frequency, or any number of things, or that's okay, but they got to go overhead the airport, where now you're in a telephone game. And so as an approach controller, I like to avoid that. And if I can't have a transition and through Delta in the way that I can do without coordination, I will force the data tag onto the scope in the tower. And I'll just say, contact this tower for the Delta transition, because I don't want to be involved in the conversation if I don't add any value to the conversation as an approach controller. So I would say down low through Cecil is still a good spot for me.
Okay, before I leave you here, down low through Cecil, you call Cecil, mm-hmm. tower controller pulls what Wally said, aircraft calling Cecil, stand by.
Yep.
Remain clear of Class Delta.
Remain clear of the Class Delta. Now you're out there circling slowly in your air coupe.
I wouldn't.
Can you bail in that situation, and how would you do it? Because you've initiated contact. They've told you to stand by as an air traffic controller and a pilot. Can the pilot exit that initiated communication, and how would they do it if they get tired of being out there?
Without a doubt. I would say that if they told me to stand by, I wouldn't even start to orbit out there. I would start to circumnavigate the Delta. And then if they came back to me a moment later, all right, great, now I can cut through. Mm-hmm. But if they don't get back to me, that's fine. My plan B is I'll go around the Delta because I want to stay down low and I want to be entering that airport traffic area at the pattern altitude rather than be descending into the pattern.
And no harm, no foul in that. You don't exactly. have to call back and say, you know what, never mind, or something. They see you going another direction. Well, apparently he didn't like my answer kind of thing.
Pretty much.
Sarah.
Kind of a question for you. So pilots that get flight following and want to navigate through complex airspace, how much work is it for the controller to reach out to those different facilities, to those different Class Ds or even Class Cs if you're flying en route? Is it a lot of work? Is it something that somebody can expect the controller to do for them? Or is there a lot of circumstances where they're going to have to then coordinate with each individual tower or approach airspace themselves?
That's very situational, and it's going to depend. There are not different from any other line of work. There are some people that are really easy to work with. There are some people that are a bit more of a challenge to work with. And it's not different dealing with air traffic facilities. When you have an adjacent facility, sometimes they're very receptive to the manual coordination like we're talking about. Other times they're not so receptive. So you got to kind of roll with that, and it could change day to day based on the traffic situation or who's working that day.
I can just add a little more in that. Just, you know, the process varies tremendously depending upon the kinds of facilities and their procedures. Places that, as Kevin said, you know, work closely together to adjacent approach controls or whatever. It could be as simple as something that you do automation-wise. You can make a keyboard entry and take the data block on that airplane, flash it to somebody else, force it to them, and they all have rules on how they do that. You may have to, it's not like picking up the phone, but you just hit a button and you know, there would be something like Cecil approach on the whatever line, 5 West is blah, blah, blah. Okay, point out approved. It could be as simple as that, or it could be much more involved depending upon what has to be done. But guys that are doing this kind of stuff regularly pretty much have that down. And I would think the JAX people know that when Cecil's on a north operation, don't even try and go to the north side or, you know, that kind of stuff where they know in advance what they can do and what they can't do.
Kevin.
Just to build on that also, the other part of that, the tower controller could have a situation where there are zero airplanes in the pattern and they could tell the approach controller, absolutely, you can work this airplane blasting right through at pattern altitude and it's not going to hurt me or anybody else. That's fine. Or they could say, oh, I have traffic here. I'm going to need to talk to them or stay out.
Yeah. Wally.
Kevin, that's a great explanation. But what do you think the chances are on a beautiful weekend day that they have nobody in their pattern?
You'd be surprised at the magnetic qualities of aluminum. Airplanes, it's uncanny the way that it shakes out. Airplanes seem to come and go from airports and to airports in clumps.
Clumps, yeah.
And it always works out that way. And if you're coming through in a lull, then that happens sometimes. And it can be, wow, it's a good thing you didn't come through here 10 minutes ago. We never would have let you through. Now there's nobody.
Yeah. My experience in Florida airports, especially on weekends, are very busy, all of them.
But a Navy training facility probably is not doing anything on a Sunday.
You're right.
Yeah.
That could be.
Yeah, I have a question for the controllers. You know, there is, especially with a lot of students, reluctance to communicate with air traffic control. They'll try to circumnavigate as much as they can. I've heard from numerous controllers that you all, in most cases, prefer to hear from somebody. Therefore, you kind of know where they're going, their intentions, if they're even right outside your airspace. Is that something you welcome? Would you rather somebody be talking to you so you have an idea?
Yeah, I think that's generally a fair statement. If I know that you're not going to be above a particular altitude, then I don't have to bother you with traffic that's going to be above some amount above that. Or if I know you're only going to be working in a particular area, I can even move IFR traffic around somebody that's VFR flying around if I know that a VFR target is going to be working in a particular area.
There's certainly going to be a lot of traffic in the area down here, flight training, other training. Okay, now that corridor that you're going to fly through, well, let's suppose you look on your ADS-B in through your portable receiver, because you're probably going to pick up enough targets anyway. There's just so much flying around. It's just chock full of airplanes. Is there anything wrong with sort of a variation on the one thing that wasn't chosen, which was option three, to stay above, to actually stay above, cross completely over her lung, well above, and descend to the east, and then come back in, right? It's kind of a busy airspace out there too, but I was interested that nobody brought that one up. I was actually kind of expecting somebody to pick that up as a possibility too. Does that seem like another reasonable way that would meet your needs? It's not as fun down slow, low and slow, but you get around the airspace as well. I bring it up because people probably will.
Yeah, I liked that option, Jeff. I did. I think it probably would have been my second choice, is to fly overhead and then just do a descending turn. It was a little more demanding, and you had to keep track of the airspace. It didn't give you as much time because you're now going to be in this crowded turning descent while you're changing frequencies. So it was a little more demanding to me, but I think that was my second choice.
The whole mission doesn't end here with getting into Herlong either, right? You've gotten into the eye of the hurricane. You now have to get out of the eye of the hurricane. Wally, you brought back up, hey, I'm just going to go back up the railroad tracks and around. Yep. Again, beautiful, low, slow day.
Yep.
The other option could potentially be to go through the corridor there under the shelf of the Class Charlie airspace. And we can do that without ADS-B. Can't go through, can't go over. Unfortunately, there's a stadium there. And when that stadium TFR comes up, it almost fully blocks the path, right? Just sort of plugs it. Yeah. So I want to go back to, is it possible to get through the Class Charlie airspace without ADS-B with permission? And what would that take? Kevin's shaking, you're shaking your head like, I have no idea. Is that something that's possible? Or you just, it's going to be situation facility dependent, or absolutely no way?
As an air traffic controller,
yeah.
If somebody calls me up that doesn't have ADS-B, but they do have their transponder functioning,
there's
a very good chance I'm going to just not notice that they don't have ADS-B and work them through just the same.
Sort of a no harm, no foul kind of thing here.
But I believe there are other procedures and authorizations that you're supposed to get, but I don't know the details on that. I couldn't claim to be an expert on that part of it.
Right. John, any thoughts on that?
No, pretty much the same thing.
Us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the STARS display, you can't even really, you have to do another entry, right, to even display the ADS-B. So you're not using it, you would never know.
You would never know, right? But it is definitely required. Richard.
Jeff, one more factor to consider with that is if you go skirting underneath that Class Charlie there, you got to be at 1,200 feet over what looks like to be a pretty crowded metro area there.
Yeah.
So are you abiding by the intent of the rule that says a safe altitude in case your engine quits? You know, I forget the chapter and verse of that. But to me, you're pushing the limits on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the takeaways from this clearly is get ADS-B installed, you know, just to kind of remove some of these things and maybe invest in a handheld too. There's still yet one more mission, and I wanted to get onto that because these are questions we get asked sometimes too. You did your skydive, you got back into Herlong, and now you're going to go back to the west, and you want to get flight following on the ground at Herlong in order to go back out. What's the best way for someone to do that? Because you actually do want to be, say, talking to Jacksonville approach before you can launch up and get over the top. Kevin, what would be the best way from the ground at Herlong to get flight following from the ground, or is that just not going to be possible?
I think it's going to depend on the facility. I think most places, they're going to want you to just call airborne for VFR advisories.
Mm-hmm. John, you'd agree with
that,
too?
Definitely. Most controllers are very reluctant to give a code to a VFR on the ground at a non-towered airport because you never know when they're going to take off. You never know if they abort for some mechanical reason or something. Now you're wondering, hey, I gave this guy a code 15 minutes ago and he never showed up. Do we call search and rescue? Is he, you know, crashed off the end of the runway and stuff? So they're going to be very reluctant to do that.
So that's one of those things, you know, we try and remove things that make our lives busier, right? To move high workload events to low workload events, you're stuck with this one. Right.
Pretty much.
So if you're going to call Jacksonville approach for exiting out of here, kind of head out, spiral up to try and go over the top, talk to them, and take it from there.
I was just going to add one more thing that I just noticed the other day. Someone pointed out to me, you were talking about parachute jumping and stuff, mm-hmm. And it's a new feature to me, that on ForeFlight in the aeronautical layer, they show parachute jumping areas as orange circles.
Oh, interesting. I had not noticed
that. I had not noticed that either until someone pointed it out to me.
You know, this scenario, it's amazing. It's just all about knowing where to look and who to talk to. It sounds like frequencies that are the same, notes in the chart supplement, local procedures, things we learned by just making a phone call. There's a lot to talk about here. But when you're looking at it, even for all the resources that we have displayed in pixels, it seems like the best thing, the most valuable thing in kind of de-escalating the complication here is getting on the phone and talking to someone locally. And in our digital age, it's like we've almost forgotten how to do that. Sometimes the best flight planning is just to call and ask.